Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, friends, I'm Michael Lawrence. I'm the Chief Executive of Asia House. Welcome to the UK launch of Reimagining India, unlocking the potential of Asia's next superpower. Reimagining India is a collection of 60 original essays from a quite extraordinary list of thought leaders from business, policy, academia, the media, arts and culture, all talking about the challenges and the opportunities faced by India. It's been edited and curated by McKinsey & Company, a big supporter of Asia House and a big supporter of our mission of connecting the UK with Asia. We're going to talk about the book this evening. It is the official launch, but to mark that launch, we're going to have a panel discussion on the book, its contents, but a broad discussion on India overall. We'll be looking at the issues that arise in Reimagining India, but as part of our discussion, we want your involvement as well. We want your views, we want your thoughts, we want your questions. So we will be engaging with you very early on in the piece. Before we start our panel discussion, I'd like to invite Dr. Varinder Paul, the Acting India High Commissioner to the UK, to say just a few words. Dr. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. I promise I won't take too long because we are all looking forward to a very interesting panel discussion. Distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, to begin with, I would like to thank Asia House for inviting me to this book launch of the recent book, Reimagining India, edited by McKinsey & Company. And I'm most grateful to McKinsey & Company, in particular to Mr. Dominic Barton, who I understand is not here with us today, for sharing a copy of the book. And in Mr. Barton's kind words, it was in recognition of the importance of India and the role it plays in our global economy and society today. I have glanced through the book. I have gone through some reviews and commentaries on the book, and the impression I got is that the overall sentiment towards India is positive and promising, and I'm sure that this sentiment will get further reinforced when I finish reading the book. I would also like to congratulate all those eminent personalities, the contributors to the book, and my compliments to their expertise and research. Before I came here, I was just sharing with Michael, I looked up the Asia House website, and I'll share with you. I'll just read out the announcement of today's event as it appeared on the website, and I quote, "The frenzied optimism of the past decade for the Indian experiment has now given way to disappointment amongst observers of India inside and outside the country. There is mounting frustration that India's promise would be fading." And it ends with a question, will India fulfill its true potential? The question itself, you know, suggests that the jury is still out. The title of the book, you know, as it appears on the front of the book, is Reimagining India, Unlocking the Potential of Asia's Next Superpower. So here, you know, there is some degree of definitiveness on where India is going. I observe that words such as reimagining and rediscovering, when used with India, might possibly give a different meaning to India. India, as you all know, has been a reality for a long time. But I think the use of such words in a Western discourse may be understandable, because I assume that India is being viewed here today in a limited period of history. I would personally prefer the phrase re-emerging India to put it in the larger, longer historical context. Regardless of the multiplicity of views, which is of course inevitable, the bottom line is, and you know, the contributors to the book and all of us present here, I'm sure, the bottom line is that India matters. I will take just a couple of minutes, you know, to very briefly share with you how I look at it, you know, what India is all about. We are a country, a living civilization of over 1.2 billion people, which is more than twice of the total population of the European Union. About 50% of our population is below the age of 25. India is extremely diverse in terms of language, religion, culture, race, and the rest of it. All major religions of the world are represented in India. And this diversity in India, which is not divisive, is what defines India. Over the last 20 years, our economy has been growing at an average of 7%, and over the last 10 years or so, it has been growing at an average of around 8%. We are passing through a dip at the present moment, and we have all reasons to believe that we are passing through a transient phase. We have a middle class of about 300 million. You know, while I say all these good things about India and India's economy, at the same time, you know, we have millions and millions of people who are still suffering from ignorance, disease, and poverty. These are big challenges. These are big challenges for one of the fastest growing large developing economies. And this is what drives India to seek sustainable and inclusive development. And as we do so, we involve the civil society, private sector, local governments, and all other stakeholders. In parallel, as we do so, we are engaging with the outside world to build new partnership and strengthen old relationships. And our partnerships, you know, whether at bilateral, regional, or global levels, are shaped by our developmental priorities. This is very important. And the single most important objective of our foreign policy has to be to create a global environment that is conducive to the well-being of our country. You know, this experiment, the word experiment has been used, you know, at several places in this book, so I also tend to use this word here. India's successful experiment of pursuing economic development within the framework of a plural, secular, and liberal democracy has inspired people around the world. And one last point that I would like to mention here is on how do we measure progress of a country like India? And I think it's very important. You know, it's critical to see at what level we stand today and where we are going in the coming decades. But I think for a country like India, it's equally important to take into account where we started about 65 years ago when India gained independence. With these words, I conclude. And Michael, thank you once again for inviting. And I look forward to a very interesting conversation. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and it's wonderful to have you here tonight. So time now for our panel discussion. We want to move straight in. My guests are Adil Zainalbai, who's chairman, McKinsey & Company India, and also contributing editor to Reimagining India. Congratulations, by the way, on a fantastic book. Bill Emmett, an independent writer and consultant on international affairs and former editor of The Economist. Bill authored a chapter on India's relationship with the greater Asian region. Great stuff. Thank you very much. We're also joined by Dalit Pathak, who's senior advisor to Warburg Pincus, a major global private equity firm with a strong franchise in India. Dalit established the firm's presence in India and was responsible for it for almost two decades. And also, he's also, I'm delighted to say, trustee of Asia House. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Now, for those so inclined, we are tweeting tonight and encouraging you to do so. Please join in the conversation. At Asia House Bus Poll, which is short for business policy, rather harder to say and spell, so Asia House Bus Poll, and hashtag ReIndia. So we want to engage a wider community other than those who are in the room, but of course you have the privilege of asking questions and stating your views. Adil, let me start with you. You know, two questions to open. You know, why the book? Why now? But also, what are the key themes that have emerged? You've got 60 writers, quite breathtaking range of intellects and thought leaders there. But are there any two or three key themes that emerged throughout those essays?
Okay. We started working on this book about a year ago, and there was a sense that while the potential of India was still, in the long term, very high, as the ambassador, talked about this, that in fact there was mounting frustration that a whole series of actions, either within India or circumstances that it found itself in, was leading to a decline in the growth of the country, but more importantly, not just the growth of the country, because GDP numbers are a treadmill that, you know, don't describe everything that's going on, but, you know, the fact that the lives of 1.2 billion people were not improving as fast as what anyone would like. Okay, so that's the real issue. And we felt that, you know, while India was growing very fast, there was huge euphoria, and now it was sure depression. And neither the euphoria was justified, nor is the depression. And because people are viewing this from the point of view of headlines that are made around the world, we thought that a better dialogue would give people a more nuanced view of what was happening. You know, many of the issues that we talk about today going forward were also there during the fastest growth period that India has ever seen. So it's not as though they weren't there at that time, but that time there was just euphoria. And now we focus only on those issues and not the fact that the country has done well for 20 years and 5% is, you know, not so bad, except in relation to the 8 or 9% that it grew at. So that was our idea, and we thought rather than do a study which was filled with charts from McKinsey, that which nobody would read, sorry. But we thought that it would be better to get 60 voices, business, economics, from India's soft power, from India's foreign policy, to come together and kind of paint an impressionist picture of what's out there. So that was our idea. And because it's 60, it's 64 actually, but because it's so many different people writing, it's not a single unified theme. Okay, people, some are positive, and I say, it's not an India shining book, for those of you who remember the famous phrase, India shining, but it's also not an India depressing book. Okay, I think it tries to lay out realistically what the situation is, what the challenges are, and what can be done. And so that's what we were trying to do. So with that as context, a few themes come out which are interesting that I'll just put on the table. Number one, in this election coming up, 30% of the people who vote in the election have never voted before. They were born after the reforms were done, and they are being driven not by what happened in the past, but by the aspirations that have been set for the Indian people because of the growth that we have. So that theme comes out, which is the aspirations of the young and the aspirations of a billion people will force a democracy to do something that improves their lot, right? So that's one theme that comes out in many essays. A second theme that comes out in many essays is on governance. And the point that those six or seven essays, including Anand Mahindra, Ashutosh Varshini, and others make is, we always think of India as this one entity, right? And therefore, central government, and therefore, you know, all the news and headlines that come out of India as a whole. But in reality, some of the most interesting things on the development side, as well as on the economic side, are being done in the states. And for the first time, we're starting to see strong people emerge in states, strong governments emerge in states that are being re-elected time and time again based on what they have delivered, not because they came from one particular caste or not. And that change, if it continues, will actually be very good for the country, because then states will learn from each other. And, you know, people will say, that state's doing well, but, you know, we're better than them, so we should do better, right? And that will come out. So that's the second theme. A third very interesting theme is that while we have actually we've done very badly on social indicators such as primary education, education for girls, and malnutrition of children, to name three things. Technologies that are just coming in right now could allow India to leapfrog. And so there's an essay on leapfrog by Vinod Khosla. There's an essay on the impact on healthcare by Sunil Mittal. And there's one by the CEO of Cisco and one by the CEO of Google, which all talk about the fact that because these technologies are coming together, what could take 25 years otherwise could be done in 5 years, right? So that's another theme that comes across. So people are more positive because of this opportunity. Now, that doesn't mean to say India will do it, but the opportunity is there to do that. So I think there are many others, but those at least are some of the themes that come out.
Okay. Bill, you contributed to the book. Would it be fair to say that if this was written 5 years ago by the same 64 authors, it would have been more positive? Have things shifted dramatically in that last 5 years?
Well, I think, well, first of all, let me thank you for having me here and for giving me the honor of being in the book. Of course, Adil, I'd like to point out, is concealing the true marketing genius of McKinsey with this book, because it's timed, they brought it out, Reimagine India, timed for India's most important historical change in the last 20 years, which is the retirement of Sachin Tendulkar.
Yes.
Okay. So this is obviously was your plan.
Forgive me for not mentioning that. Sorry, it should have been
huge.
That's right.
Out of pessimism. To your question, Michael. I mean, I think I'll answer it by saying, if you look back 10, 12 years, you would have had actually in the early part of this century, you would have had actually a relatively downbeat view of India at that point. Mm-hmm. And I say that with a sense of mea culpa, because I wrote a book that was published in 2003 called 2021 Vision. I included chapters on, if you like, the major powers, and I didn't include India. And now this was probably my failing.
Yes.
But I think it reflected to some extent that India wasn't quite sort of at the euphoria stage by then. Mm-hmm. 5 years later, of course I'd have included India in a book had I published it then. So
if you published it now?
Oh, sure, I would include it, absolutely. And I think that Adil's right, that the euphoria was way overdone, the real ability of the economy to grow had not been transformed in the way that the euphoria suggested. But nevertheless, progress was never going to be a straight line. It's a bumpy road. Particularly when you have inflation and the price of onions being as they are and all of these things, it's actually, India is the only country I've seen in my old magazine or in others where, you know, election stories begin with the price of onions. and it's a very dramatic backdrop to the elections now. So it's always going to be a bumpy road. But I think, actually, there's a quote towards the end of the book from Montek Singh Ahluwalia, I think, who says that the thing about India is that there's a strong consensus for weak reforms. I think we should be optimistic that, especially with the new governor of the central bank, mm-hmm. Determined to stamp out inflation, which I think is one of the scourges, actually, of Indian investment and Indian progress, compared with particularly the obvious comparator, China. That actually we should expect a better next 5 years or a better next 10 years than the previous five. Mm. It would be the right bet to make.
Okay. Dilip, you obviously spent so many years in India and developed a very vibrant business there. Do you get a sense, not only from the book but from your contacts in the business there, of frustration, disappointment where India is at the moment?
Well, of course there is. And in India, but I subscribe to Bill's view over here that development doesn't happen in a straight line. Mm-hmm. Like the stock market, Indians are manic depressors. One day, extremely happy. The next day, very depressed. But I don't think these are important issues. And actually, I must pay a compliment to McKinsey for this book. I urge you to buy it because they haven't paid me for this. He hasn't invited me out. But it's a thought-provoking read. But there were a couple of things that were missing over there, and which I want to highlight. Because to me, inflation, current account deficit, currency problems, etc., these are easily fixable problems. They sometimes take 2 or 3 years to get back on track. You bring in Raghuram Rajan as governor of the central bank, you bring in a few people, you'll get back on track. I have two main concerns, which frankly have not been one has not been addressed in the book at all, and the other one sort of tangentially. The first one has to do with the rule of law. All the ideas, brilliant ideas one comes up with, will come to nothing if we do not maintain what we have maintained for the bulk of the period since independence, which is we prided ourselves in the rule of law. However, investors, including in businessmen in India, have been quite concerned over the last 2 to 3 years about the happenings on this front of rule of law. The Vodafone case is one. Mm-hmm. We won't go into the details over here. But secondly, you know, I was shocked to read, someone brought this to my attention just a couple of days ago. Someone said to me that, you know, the enforceability of commercial contracts, India is very weak at that. And we're at the bottom of the list of nations on that. And you know, I went onto the internet yesterday. And this is a website, this quotes the World Bank and the IFC, as credible as McKinsey, okay? And it says that in terms of enforceability of commercial contracts, India was listed 186th out of 189 countries. Bangladesh ahead of us, Angola behind us. This won't do, okay? The country will get derailed if this kind of thing continues. The other has to do with employment. And let's look at hard facts over here, okay? So India has an addition of 10 million to the workforce every year. Over the next 20 years, about 200 million people additions to the workforce. China, if you had asked experts a month ago, would have said there will be no additions to the workforce in China. Now they've changed their one-child policy, so who knows? You know, maybe it'll be an addition of 10 or 15 million. The US, they say, will go up by 10 or 15 million, okay? During the same period, Europe goes down by 60 million. India goes up by 200 million people, and we are creating 1 million jobs approximately a year. So forget about growth rates, forget about inflation. These issues are going to have to be addressed upfront, and the proclivity that we have right now of sliding back to welfare socialism is not going to solve the problem.
Elections next year, and they're obviously very high on the radar screen, and many countries and many world and many parts of history, elections have been critical to the development of that country, but many analysts say these next ones are absolutely and utterly key for India. What's the view of the panel on the outcome of those elections? Are we looking at a coalition? And Modi, very controversial figure, but one who has popular support on the one side and causes deep divisions in others. What's the readout on the election?
You want me to start?
Please. I started the last one.
Okay, then. I'll guess. Because that's all it can be at this stage. I mean, well, a pretty 100% firm prediction is yes, there will be a coalition.
Yes.
I don't think it's difficult to predict that. But at this stage, with not even knowing the date of the election, I mean, we've seen in Indian elections in the past the ability to spring surprises. So I think it's possible. But, you know, as a working expectation, I think one should assume that Modi will be the next prime minister.
I'm not a betting man. No, I don't think one can predict the situation. I agree with Bill. It is going to be a coalition, but it could go either way.
So I'd just like to comment on some of the factors that will affect the election.
Yes.
And if the best predictor of elections in India is to go to the betting site and see where people are putting their money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that would be a better predictor. So I would encourage you to go look at that site and you'll see who's betting on what. But I wanted to add 2 things that are going to play a role in this. Number one, 30% of the voters are people who have not voted before. And we don't know how they will vote, actually. There are lots of polls, but presumably the pattern of voting might be different because they're going to vote differently from their parents, etc. From the last election, India is urbanized by another 2 points. So there's lots more people in urban centers, whereas previously, over the last so many years, the rural population, you know, carries a lot of the burden of votes. So I think that's the second thing that will affect how the votes will go. And as you said, you know, any surprises can come up. But in terms of coalition, there's 100% chance that there will be a coalition because no party is likely to get a majority vote, so they'll have to work with others. And while I can't predict, because it's impossible, I think, to predict exactly who will win, what what you can think about is, independent of whoever comes in charge, what are the kinds of things that they are going to have to do to get the country back on track to a faster improvement in the living standards of people, right? So that, I think, is actually quite important to think about. And if you think of some of the longer term issues, you can think about the three or four things they're going to have to do. One is, there are many, many decisions that are just stuck. They're stuck in Parliament. Ed Luce has a wonderful essay in the book that compares the US government and the Indian government, and his conclusion is that both are broken, that neither of them can pass laws, but the US is pretty rich, so if they don't pass any laws, it's okay. And India desperately needs to pass a series of laws to modernize some of the things that need to get done. So whichever government comes in place has to be able to pass a reasonable set of laws, both commercial and others, to get that. That's one. Second, whichever government comes in place is going to have to be in a position that changes the dynamic with the bureaucracy. Just as the commercial law issues and the rule of law has affected business decisions, a couple of recent CBI cases where they went after some of the senior bureaucrats after they retired and are filing cases against them for coal and others has created a situation where most senior bureaucrats who are very, very powerful and can do many things have said it's too risky. Unless I get a written instruction from the minister, I'm not going to do it. And so as a result of that, many things have stopped. And so the next government, whoever it is going to have to get things moving, because things can't just stop. That'll hurt the thing. So that's the second one, a thing that one has to look for in terms of what the government will do. And I think the third thing is, another interesting spoiler in this election is the fact that the middle class that we talked about has also become politically active, which it was not very active. And one very interesting example of that is in Delhi, where this new party called the Aam Aadmi Party came out of nowhere and is currently polling between 12 and 14%. Their only plank is not corrupt, no corruption. And they are getting 12 to 14% of the votes, which in a few elections back, or even in the last election, would have been unthinkable for somebody to do that. And so that those dynamics, I think, will make not only make the election interesting, but will make what happens after the election, and in terms of what needs to get done, very interesting.
I do want to bring the audience in on this, because obviously the election's a key story on the agenda for next year. But just before I do that, paralysis of the bureaucracy is clearly a major stumbling block for anything. Can any coalition free up that paralysis, or does it have to be a particular coalition with reform in mind? Because that is one of the big stumbling blocks.
I'm actually quite optimistic, because I think these things turn very quickly. In one of the stories in the book, they talk about the fact that there were different times in India's history when, for a variety of reasons, things had just gotten stuck. With the right leadership, so take the bureaucracy. The same bureaucrat, when he's in central government, is currently not taking decisions because they're worried about all of this, right? To simplify. The same bureaucrat, when he goes to a state with a strong leader, where, suddenly is doing wonderful things. So we haven't, so it's the same person in a different environment will behave as you would like him to behave or her to behave. So I think these things turn very, very quickly. With the right kind of leadership, this thing will go away. It's not a structural issue that one has to address over 10 years. I think these things will go away, because at the end of the day, these are very, very talented and powerful people who nobody wants to become a bureaucrat so they can do nothing. It's a very... So I think that'll get solved pretty quickly. Once it's clear who, and there's somebody who's in... who imposes their will, it'll get solved very quickly.
But the rule of law...
I was only going to reinforce what you say, just to say that certainly, although one shouldn't ever say, oh, it's, we need a brilliant government and everything will follow, nevertheless, the sense of drift, of indecision, of anomie, really, feeds through very quickly into the all of the organs of power in a country like India, doesn't it? I mean, so I agree with you. If you've got someone who really had an agenda and actually was, for at least for a while, clear what they were going to do, then I think the bureaucracy would react at least to a large extent. But I do share your position about the rule of law. I think that's a very vital.
And that sounds like a much tougher nut to crack because you know it's an incredibly low rating. It's what we hear from many of our stakeholders here that doing business in India is hard because if you end up in the courts, you're never going to come out of them. And that's a fairly common theme.
Can I comment on that? Just the rule of law, sorry.
Yeah.
My memory is not what it is, so I can't remember what's on every page of the book. But
so, a little test is the next question.
I can respond to that because I read that article.
Oh, good, good. Why don't you respond to that? Thank you.
So
Zia Modi's article.
Zia Modi's article,
right.
And
thank
she's
you.
A friend, so I read it. So Zia makes the point that India has roughly 1/4 the number of judges that India needs, okay? And clearly that leads to a delay in justice, and justice delayed is justice denied. But I am talking about something else. I am talking about this unusual situation over the last 3 years where there has been a slippage when it comes to commercial contracts. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Vodafone case is truly unusual, mm-hmm. okay? Where the government has essentially challenged the Supreme Court of India. But hopefully it's a one-off. Hopefully things will change, and I'm one of those who, again, there seems to be consensus on this panel on one thing. Whilst I do believe that as in Britain, as anywhere else in the world, there is scope to improve in the bureaucracy is not a binding constraint. Because given the right leaders, the same bureaucracy performs miracles. So at least on that we're agreed.
Okay, censorship. Now I want to bring in the audience now, if I may. Microphone. And if you can identify yourself to the panel and the audience, please.
Deepak Lalwani from Lal Cap. I specialize on India. You mentioned about corruption, and obviously it's of enough concern that it can create a 12 to 14% swing, you know, with a party which has only been set up very recently. But many believe that corruption in India is institutionalized. Can one person at the top make a difference? And my question is, what will make a difference, and will technology have some sort of impact, you know, where people are not dealing with it on a discretionary basis, everything is computerized? Would that help at all?
There is no single essay on corruption, but corruption runs like a leitmotif through many essays, right? And I'll give you three or four different examples of that. This is a question that we were thinking about quite a lot, and so I've been asking lots of Nobel Prize winning economists that I run into about what's the impact of corruption on growth, right, of India. And I said, for a second, if you take away the moral imperative, right, just think about it purely as an economist, what's the effect? And there's three or four different angles that people have told me about, so I'll just bring those up. Number one, most emerging countries, when they're going through this growth period, there is corruption, and there is zero chance that all corruption in India will go away in the next 10 years. It just doesn't happen. Many developed countries, so now this is my view, now this is what the economists tell me, right? One of the Nobel Prize winning economists said, he said, from an economist standpoint, all you're worried about is whether resources are being channeled efficiently and effectively, and corruption is one way of not getting it to the optimal place. Right? That's one way. He says, but before you can answer the impact of corruption on growth, you have to answer the question of whether that is legalized corruption or illegal corruption. In India, it's illegal corruption. You give money and you expect something. Legalized corruption is where there are certain rules. So you can lobby for something that's legal, but it changes resource allocation. But he said, the thing that makes the biggest difference is not whether there's corruption or not, but it's wrong decisions. The cost of a wrong decision is significantly higher than the cost of corruption on an economy like India's. This is their view. I'll give you another example. By and large, everybody will agree, and I don't know, we don't want to put you on the spot, but let's just assume, maybe you also agree, that in India, the party that has been least corrupt for many years, since its founding, is the Communist Party of India. Communist Party of India, you know, the guy lives in a dormitory room above party headquarters, the leader of the party. And they are, by and large, the least corrupt. Okay? But their effect on India may be pretty severe as a result of the decisions that they took. So in the development of the country and in the improvement of people's living standards, which is what we're trying to get to, one has to look at not just the impact of corruption, but the impact of decisions and bad decisions. So for this, for the last 5 years, if you had to separate out what was the impact of corruption versus what was the impact of bad decisions, many people would argue that it was the impact of bad decisions rather than corruption that affected it. So, you know, it's a complicated subject. You might have a view on it.
Well, my main view would be I agree with you that it's not something you can expect not to be there, but it's the capriciousness of it, I think, that is particularly damaging to business.
Yep.
I mean, the sense that, first of all, you don't get what you pay for. I mean, and that it's so unpredictable and according to swirling power structures, I think that makes it very particular. It comes back to the
rule. So you like predictable corruption.
Predictable corruption makes. Okay. So in fact, if you bribe a Saudi prince, I'm afraid it's predictable what the effect will be. You know, you get the contract if you've paid enough, but because you know where he is. So in fact, predictable corruption works. By the way, I did go to a dinner a few years ago in Calcutta. Where the other guests included Jyoti Basu, the great communist premier of West Bengal, and we were all served a wonderful champagne and caviar to start. And he seemed to enjoy it, but it was possibly because he couldn't afford it, like me.
Can I make one other point on corruption, just on this issue of predictable corruption? So one of the professors at MIT has been doing research into corruption in a large country that also begins with I, but it's not India, so I'm not allowed to say that, what it is. So
I think I can guess. I've been making films about it.
Right.
Yes,
so
Italy.
One of the things that he had, they allowed him to do, is to look at all road contracts given out there. And I'll make a long story short and said, what he found is that the roads that were built the fastest and the cheapest, first of all, there's corruption in all road contracts, so that's a given. The ones that were built fastest and cheapest were the ones where there was predictable corruption.
Yeah,
you gave money to one person and that person took care of everything. The ones that were the worst were ones where every mile you had to pay somebody else, and then the steel guy wanted something and this guy wanted something, and that those wind up costing an enormous amount. So his conclusion after all of this was predictable corruption. If you had to have corruption, have predictable corruption.
No, clearly from an economist's point of view, that's right.
Sorry.
I hate to say to some extent I agree with you on the corruption aspect, because it's a
you're
cost.
You're agreeing with me too much. There
no,
two
but I'm not going to agree on the next point.
Okay.
So I agree with I agree with you up to a point, because it's a cost of doing business. But taken too far, it leads to undermining the rule of law.
Yeah.
Yes.
But where I disagree with you is, and that is what is leading to paralysis in the bureaucracy. I totally disagree that it is dangerous to make bad decisions. Bad decisions can be corrected. No decisions, there is no room for correction. You just don't do anything. We make bad decisions in business and the commercial world all the time. But as long as we're making 70% good decisions, we're fine. Whereas today, the bureaucracy has been put on the spot, and if they make a single bad decision, they get hung, and therefore they don't make any decisions.
Yeah. Okay. Right, back to
I think
you.
We have a question
from the other room.
Yes.
Thank you. Hi there. I'm looking forward to reading your book. My name is Fareed Haq. I'm from Early Stage Magazine. I have a question for the panel about culture. So I think corruption, I think, is everywhere. You can't get away with it. They have these lists on, you know, the most corrupt country and the least corrupt countries. It's a relative list. But my question is around safety and culture. Recently in India, the gang rape of, women in public, that caused an enormous outcry from the public. I'm just keen to understand the panel's perspective on, you know, what is the culture change that is happening in India today as a result of such outrageous behaviors, and you know, how do you think that is going to affect the economics going forward?
I don't think I can answer that.
So, the two big incidents that you referred to. One was, of course, in Delhi, and the other one happened in Bombay more recently. And you know, they were terrible. They were really terrible, and they highlighted a culture where people felt that they could get away with it, so they did more. So it is really a horrible thing, and I think it has to change over time. There's only one slight silver lining in it, which is, I think, an important one, which is it outraged people in a way that few other things that outraged people. And suddenly the middle, you know, without any, if you remember this, I don't know if you followed that, the political parties said nothing, nothing. But the middle class and the urbanites and the people in urban centers, Bombay, Delhi, and others, were so outraged by this that that momentum created by that outrage actually led to a lot of change. And new laws were passed, there were courts that are going to act very quickly on it. And in fact, in Bombay, when this happened, before when it happened, first of all, nobody would even lodge an FIR. And if they did, people weren't caught for years. And if they were caught, the case wouldn't come up for years. Here, in 24 hours, they caught five of the people in three different cities around India. In 24 hours, they were able to find them, catch them, and they put them on fast trial courts, et cetera, and things are moving. So this is what I mean by when the voters who are now getting to be middle class or the young voters get excited, they can create a momentum of their own and they can start tackling issues that, you know, we can't just leave to the government to tackle individually. And in this particular case, and even in the corruption cases, really the government really didn't do anything. You know, it was forced on them by the outrage of a very large group of citizenry that got organized spontaneously. You know, it was not organized by any party or any committee or anything, it just got organized spontaneously. And I think that's the silver lining, that as the electorate, and as the urban centers and as the young people get energized by an issue like corruption, like the role of women, and they start demanding something, then in a democracy, people will respond. Right, because they have no choice, otherwise they'll be thrown out in the next election, right? So that's the only silver lining that says things are starting to move because people are demanding something from the government.
But there are, thank you very much, there are obviously huge social issues that need to be tackled in India, education, malnutrition, hunger, poverty. Seems like a monumental task when you're looking at it from the outside. When you have bureaucratic paralysis, political paralysis, falling growth, falling currency, high inflation. Where does that fit on the political agenda, and how realistic is it to expect in the next 5 years India to make progress on these core social issues?
So on the issue of, I mean, listen, these are generational issues, right? You cannot go from the levels of poverty that India had 30 years ago to zero very quickly, right? So, and there's been a lot of progress in the last 10 years, but it will take a long time to get there. So let's take just one of them for a second. Let's take education, primary education. At the end of the day, no country in the world has figured out how to do primary education without the government doing it. Secondary, you can have private schools, but primary is really tough, right? You have to get the government doing it. All countries that have seen good growth and high standards of living achieve 90% plus literacy rates at primary school levels. In India, if you look across the states, so first of all, for the GDP per capita India has, forget about comparing it to the UK or France or the US or even China. For the GDP per capita India has, its literacy rate is shocking. It should be higher even at that GDP rate. The same thing is true for child malnutrition. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it within India, among states, there is a very, very wide discrepancy. So you have some states, for example, Kerala, where literacy is very high. Compared to other states like Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, where literacy is very low. So even within all the problems that we talked about, right? Rule of law, stifling bureaucracy, this, that, whatever. Even within that, you can achieve substantial change when people put their mind to it. Now, Kerala has some historical reasons why literacy has been higher, which goes back 100 years. But the real change came about 30 to 40 years ago in what's called the Kerala model. That Amartya Sen refers to as the Kerala model, where the government, for a variety of reasons, started paying attention to primary education and infant malnutrition. Mm-hmm. And over a 30-year period, they're substantially better than everyone else, or many other states, right? So I think that gives a little bit of hope. It's a huge problem, but it gives hope that even within the structure of the country, even within the structure of the current government or whatever it is, right, somehow this can work. And by the way, Kerala, over 30 years, has oscillated between the Congress Party and the Communist Party. Right? Every 5 years, the other government is thrown out, right? And so 5 years Congress, 5 years Congress, 5 years Congress, 5 years Congress. In that environment, with two parties whom we didn't think would be able to do that, they made some great progress.
But is it, and we talked about states versus the, you know, the central control. Is this more devolution to the states? Is this more autonomy for state administrations? Is that part of the answer to this?
Well, first of all, education is a state subject.
Yeah.
Right?
Sorry.
Well, you're asking very profound questions which need to be answered in a few minutes. First of all, the Prime Minister of India, the Education Minister of India, all these people sitting in, those of them who are sitting in Delhi, they have X number of hours in the day. Some of those hours are spent on how to run Air India. Some of those hours are spent on how to run public sector hotels. Frankly, there is no focus. I used to be with the World Bank Group once. And I remember going to Indonesia. And one thing that clearly sticks out in my mind, and by the way, those days, Indonesia was a favorite of the World Bank. It was growing at 12% a year for a very long time, which explodes the myth that you can't grow at high growth rates for a long time. Every minister you met, if you asked him, what is your objective? His response was, I have to create so many jobs this year. The same is true of China. They will break every rule in the book so long as they can employ their people. You've got to have single-minded focus. If the government of India is going to do education, healthcare, run airlines, bankrupt airlines, hotels, and be in every aspect of business so that the right people or the wrong people can make money, you're never going to get anywhere. The human mind can't remember 14-point programs. In India, we have 14-point programs, 10-point programs. You've got to take two or three things and you've got to focus on them. So it's very clear. I mean, we're backtracking from a market economy. We've got to basically get some things on cruise control. Our urban economy has to be in, you know, market economy driven. I mean, China is heading in the direction of market economy, full market economy. One realizes then that frees you up to do the kind of thing that Adil is talking about again. Your rural areas, the poor, there has to be a direct involvement of the state in areas where there's backwardness, in areas which are underdeveloped, where private sector money is disinclined to go. But then there's got to be focus, and it can be done.
Bill, do you take?
Well, I'd only add, I mean, these gentlemen are the experts, not me, but I think this idea that it can all come from competition between the states is important, but not enough, I think. I mean, I think that's an idea that we've been hearing about India for a long time, that, you know, you have the competition between the states and everything will be fine despite the dysfunction at the top. I think it's what we've seen in the recent years is that that isn't enough. Yes, you've got to have competition from the states, and that's where particularly public demand can come, and maybe where there's some more hope in some states of the political incentives being for actions that actually help the public rather than actions that distribute power to cronies. Yes, but there's also got to be an agenda set from Delhi, I think, that pushes it along to some extent. Okay. But also, I think just to add to the gentleman's very good question about violence and the rape cases, the other place I think that he rightly mentioned the culture change, that case, you know, it showed up the fact that India is essentially a very, very violent country still, of course. But also, what the worry that sort of case brings is that the pressure for punishment, for enforcement of the laws that are there, will fade. You know, when it's out of the agenda, and it'll take another ghastly case to bring it back. And I think the vital thing is that people in the media, but also civic groups, keep up the pressure. And it's got to, that sort of thing has to be a bottom-up pressure, because you know, the government in Delhi or even in the state capitals, it's too easy for them to to ignore that kind of thing. But it's most convenient to ignore.
You know, on that, that's an important social issue. Mm. I think there are certain things in life, and the United States is a democracy, but there are certain things in life which there has to be zero tolerance. Giuliani had zero tolerance for crime in New York City, and it disappeared. And I think the rape falls into that category.
Questions?
Hello, my name is Mona Sultan. You were talking a little bit earlier about that coordinated voice, that coordinated vision. Does India lack one single charismatic individual that can rally up the masses, such as Gandhiji or people before and after him? Because when you talk about things like eradicating certain norms, the way to do that can be through one voice. And at the moment, there are lots of competing voices and lots of competing priorities that muddle and create more noise. So is that what's happening in India? There's no one charismatic leader.
Is that what India lacks, one charismatic leader to rise above the other voices? Dalip, I'll start with you.
Too large a country. I think you need some leadership. At least you don't need a country that's being run in stealth where the leaders don't communicate at all. That's the other extreme, right? You need, during the time of Jawaharlal Nehru, for example, he was a great communicator. In today's world, you do need good communicators. Vajpayee, and you know, I'm agnostic between the two parties, okay? So there have been great communicators in both parties. But this is a complex country. It's, you know, this is an unprecedented experiment. 1.2 billion people being brought into the 21st century through democratic means. It is truly, I mean, it's very easy for me to sort of sit here and criticize, but it's a monumental task, and that's why I was saying you need to focus on a couple of things. Charismatic leadership helps, but when you look at the West, how did the West get ahead? It was education, scientific research, having systems in place. You know, we've got to find ways and means to put the country on autopilot, if you know what I mean. Because if we keep relying on bursts of brilliant ideas from a handful of people, that is not how you're going to take 1.2 billion people ahead.
I certainly agree with that. I mean, journalists particularly like charismatic leaders. The country, Italy, that I've been doing a lot about recently has had its fill of charismatic leaders. And let's put it this way, they're not necessarily to be recommended.
But they made fantastic copy. Fantastic copy, great cover.
I want to make a slightly different point related to this issue of charismatic leader. One of my favorite essays in the book is by Professor Yasheng Huang, who's Chinese and is at MIT and has been running the Center for Development, something like that, Economic Development. He's been studying China for 40 years and India for the last 20. And in his essay, he talks about the fact that he's done research on 130 countries or something like that to look at the link between system of governance and development. Right, because that's something that we always talk about, right? We just had, you know, I could just do everything.
Yeah.
So he found there is no statistical correlation between system of governance and growth. There are good autocracies, terrible autocracies. Good democracies, bad democracies. And in autocracies, there are a few that are very, very well, that do extremely well. Obviously, there's China, Singapore, etc. in there. I shouldn't say Singapore, they'll have me shot or something. But, you know, and there are... But
that's a family firm.
But there are more, there are many more that are a complete disaster. So there are two extremes in autocracy. In a democracy, there are a few that do very well, a few that do moderately well, a few that do okay, a few that do, you know, etc. So I think this issue of charismatic leader also come back to that. You know, most of India's reforms occurred under leaders who were not charismatic at all at some level, right? They never captured the voice of the country. Narasimha Rao was, and various others. And, you know, and given the structure of the country, you know, in the south, in Tamil Nadu, neither Congress nor BJP, nor any national party has any footing in there, right? It's DMK and AIDMK. In Orissa, there's a series of local parties. In Bihar, there's a series of local parties. In West Bengal, you know, the fight is always between Trinamool Congress and CPI and not the others. So it is fragmenting into regional parties and others. And in that environment, it is also more difficult for any charisma. And, you know, frankly, at some level, to your point, this is a very difficult thing to do. We can't wait for some leader to emerge. We'll lose 20, 30, 40 years. And what if that leader made wrong decisions? You know, it could be. So in his essay, he also says, every time he meets many Indian politicians, they all say, if I could only be an autocrat for one day and get everything done, you know? And so the question that he asked them is, which day would you choose? Would you choose the day that Dao Xiaoping, you know, got the China moving? Or would you choose the day that Mao launched the Cultural Revolution? Would you choose the day they decided to send troops into Tiananmen Square? How do you know that you would make the right choice, even if you had that day to make the choice? And that's the point that he makes. So I think, you know, the needs of the country are too urgent and too big to wait for that to happen. We have to make it happen in the system that exists today. To your point, I don't think we can wait for that. And by the way, if someone emerges and he is God, that's wonderful, right? But I'm not holding my breath.
Well, you're not going to get a sequence of gods. That's the point. Yeah.
What are you talking about? We have 350 million gods.
Yes, of course. Sorry.
Okay, more questions.
I would like to take the attention back to corruption, with your permission, if I can. We talk about systems, but what makes systems is people. Private citizens, private participants, and of course, people who qualify and become bureaucrats. I haven't read the book. I hope to find answer to this question. One thing you find in India is even private transactions between private individuals, there's a level of second guessing because people always price dishonesty when you're transacting with someone, when you're doing a private transaction. It's not contract enforcement between the government. It's not an example of Vodafone case. It's like me buying a secondhand car from my neighbor. So I'm probably not going to take everything he says. There's an element of dishonesty in the transaction there. Or similarly, if I need to get my kid admitted in a school, I'm going to bribe the principal so that I would get a spot in a place. To what extent this contributes to the structural weakness, the corruption at the structural level, that is one. And the second question I have is, how private companies like Sahara Group, you gave the example of Vodafone being kind of taken for a ride by the government. The Sahara Group, for example, is playing hide and seek with the securities regulator and the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, they are also the proud sponsor of Indian cricket team. So they are the most visible corporate brand in India. Probably their numbers don't speak as much. And we haven't seen any corporate putting an arm up and saying, I'm not going to do business with Sahara because, it might as well be an honest company, it might as well be a multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme. So corporates, to some extent, are also willing colluders in a way that contributes to this. That's second. And third thing, you work in private equity.
I think, let's take the first two, please.
That's a very long question.
Let's take the corporate question first. Are corporates, big corporates, colluding, I think is the term you used, in a culture of corruption by basically playing ball and not standing up, saying, no, we're not going to do it?
Okay, first of all, I don't know whether they're colluding or not, but let me try and respond to the question in a different way. Okay? I think one of the great successes of India over the last 15 years, so I've been critical of a lot of things, let me talk about something pleasant. One of the huge successes of India over the last 15 years is the development and the phenomenal growth of the Indian capital markets. Okay. And those capital markets, at the end of the day, it is global capital, because valuations in India are driven by external capital, not by domestic capital. Okay. Money does not typically gravitate towards those companies which indulge in corruption. I'll share a secret with you. 10, 15 years ago, Satyam had a PE, for those of you who know finance, of 16. Infosys had a PE of 35. Satyam's business model was a better business model, okay? But the valuation per unit of Infosys, was far better. That was a corruption discount, okay? The capital markets recognizing the corruption discount. Now, the secret I'll tell you is, we at Warburg Pincus invested at that point in time in Satyam. Okay? Because we said, if we invest in the company and somehow help them change their governance, even if their earnings stay flat, the value will double. Well, we failed. And 9 months later, we got out of the company because we realized we would never be able, we didn't know all the bad goings on, but we did know they were not going to change, okay? So the capital markets discriminate between companies, and they are quite unforgiving. Once a company is systematically, everyone makes mistakes, okay? And sometimes you're forced to cut corners in India because the regulation is such that you're forced to cut corners, and the market is discriminating. The market can discriminate between someone like, let's say, a Tata's, who is perhaps being forced to cut corners because an inspector is coming to their factories and will take a payoff, which even I'm sure Tata's give, as opposed to someone who's systematically corrupt. Okay? So I, at least, don't subscribe to this theory, and I think the ones who are actually creating valuable companies like the Wipros, Infosys, Bharti, etc., these are not systematically corrupt companies.
Is it also fair to say that anti-bribery legislation in the UK and the US is also forcing an improvement in governance, because international companies just can't afford to do business with corrupt companies in other parts of the world? Is that driving change as well?
Well, you know something, I don't have much time for legislation and regulation of this sort, to be very honest with you. It's very simple. If I am investing my money or his money in a company, I'm not going to want to invest it in a corrupt company. Forget about government. I couldn't be bothered about what the government thinks. From a pure commercial point of view, why would anyone want to, why would the capital markets want to put money in a corrupt company? And the word gets around. I mean, people, entrepreneurs are stupid when they think people don't know. The markets know who's cheating and who's not cheating. There are no secrets.
Right? I'll just make one comment on that issue of corruption amongst corporations and how they're behaving like that. I think the systematically over the past 10 years, as capital markets grew, it is imposing a discipline. So if you have good governance, you get a higher valuation, and that is improving. And many of the companies that engaged in systematic corruption are dying. They don't do well. Okay? That's one thing. I think MNCs are now a bigger part of the Indian landscape than they were 20 years ago. There are 40 companies with over $1 billion in revenue in India, and in the next 2 years, there'll be 80 or 100. And, you know, they are, in fact, imposing a different standard, not just on themselves, but on their suppliers. So if you are a supplier of something an MNC, the MNC has to certify that you're clean. And as a result of that, otherwise they are liable also, as a result of that, they are imposing certain standards. And over time, we hope that that will play through, over time. So we're hopeful that that systematic corruption will go. The reason in the last 10 years it may have gone up in certain areas is where the government was involved in giving out access to resources that the government controls, whether it's spectrum, iron ore, coal, copper, minerals, etc., or land, which is the single most important and valuable thing. There was, you know, there was a little bit of this crony capitalism going on, and that's what created. And there was so much money being made that undermined the system.
What about the lower level corruption, just very briefly? Anybody want to tackle that? The individual personal corruption, is this a cultural or generational issue? Does it exist? Is it as widespread?
Well, you know, there is some element of what you're talking about everywhere in the world, okay? It's not as if it doesn't happen in the Western world. I mean, you're sitting in the UK. I think the UK and, to some extent, the United States are probably the cleanest system. Actually, I'm inclined to say this is probably one of the cleanest systems in the world here in the UK because of the judiciary here, okay? And that's why so many of us actually live here, because the rule of law, I come back to the rule of law, okay? But again, I mean, people are inspired and take their, I should be diplomatic about it. When post-independence, when the leaders of India were involved in nation building and everyone was working towards building a nation, in other words, there was less of this because what was the example being set? Corruption, actually, to be very honest with you, has gotten out of control largely over the last 15 years. And it has happened with the emergence of the real estate sector and the natural resources sector in India. Okay? It sort of goes with the terrain. If you look at the list of the top 300 richest Chinese, most of them have made their money in real estate, or at least 40% of them have made their money in real estate. What happens is that this is a sector which is more prone to a nexus between politicians and businessmen. And the stakes in India, the way I like to put it, is it's the largest sale of land and resources in the history of the world. Okay? The stakes are so enormously high that, you know, unless you really have the right value system, you know, you're inclined to cut corners. And that is what has really been the tipping point, so to speak, and has this whole thing about corruption has sort of spun out of control in India. But I think enough said on that.
Okay. Sid.
Thank you. I'd like to actually ask we've heard now a lot about corruption and this and that, and India's very corrupt and India's all that, which is fine. If you look at the title of this book, it says Unlocking the Potential of Asia's Next Superpower. And I want to be able to ask the panel, superpower also involves the external environment. We've talked entirely about the internal environment of India. My own take is that a superpower should have a cogent foreign policy. My belief is, right, that India has actually no foreign policy. What it actually has is, it has initiatives which it puts forth against other people's foreign policies. For instance, our neighbor to the left, right, whichever way you want to look at it, right, Pakistan, has a very definite foreign policy. Whether you like it or you don't like it, the fact is they actually have a good foreign policy for what they want to achieve. China definitely has a foreign policy towards India, right? Equally, Bangladesh, in whichever way it wants to, it has a foreign policy towards its neighbor. And even small Sri Lanka, right, whenever it wants to cock a snook, it does. What India tends to do is it tends to react with initiatives. That if something happens, that's what it does. Therefore, what we do get labeled very often by people on the external side is that we're a soft power, right? Now, you can't be a soft power and yet be a superpower. So I'd like to be able to move this into the external environment rather than we've been going.
Is it lack of foreign policy? Is that an issue? And to be a superpower, does India really need to frame coherent narrative around foreign policy?
Funny enough, we were saying exactly the same thing downstairs. The gentleman to my right was making the point you've just made very eloquently. You have. Oh, you have. Okay, there you are. There you are.
He was just repeating it.
So there you are. But I mean, I think it's right. I mean, it's true. I mean, obviously, it's not true that there's no policies, but it is true. Now, I think you have to start the question is, do you want India to be a superpower? And really, what's going to happen, what has been happening, is that India's interests and exposure has been spreading. As the economy, as trade has expanded, as foreign investment has expanded, as the connections of India and the needs of India have expanded, so the requirement for some sort of a foreign policy is increasing. And it is often lacking, I think. But the requirement, I don't think there's a requirement to be a superpower exactly. I mean, I'm not sure that the world wants lots of superpowers, but I mean, the requirement to have a coherent view of India's national interests, which are now becoming more and more global, but like everything else, 15 years behind China's, evolution is the same thing, surely is there. And what I argue in my essay is that that would be best expressed by a more Asian vision of foreign policy and of India's position in Asia as a regional player, the significant regional player, which requires coherent thinking. It requires a sustained interest in Asian regional institutions. But from that would then arise a global position. But that's where India's principal interests lie, both in South Asia and I think increasingly in East and Southeast Asia as well, and in West Asia, of course. But I think there's quite a way to go. So my essay, which is about reinventing the Asian Relations yes. Conference of 1947, is an essay not of prediction, but of advocacy.
Very good.
So Zed, you're forcing me to respond. Okay. First of all, I have to say that's a really neat dust jacket, as they call it. But I question the term superpower, because superpower technically is a dominant country which has the ability to project power anywhere in the world and at multiple points at the same time. There is only one superpower in the world today. That's the United States. And we're not getting there in the next 20 years, so please don't look for that in this book, okay? Going back to foreign policy, I'll just share something with you because I'm not a foreign policy expert, but I have an interest in it. So I attended a conference 7 years ago at the University of Pennsylvania on India's foreign policy, and Ronan Sen happened to be there, the ambassador there. And there were about 25 academicians from various universities. And the consensus was that after Jawaharlal Nehru, there has been no clearly well-enunciated foreign policy, and that there are basically initiatives like you were suggesting. And what surprised me was that Ronan Sen himself stood up and confirmed that. So I don't know whether the ambassador here agrees or not, but just sharing something that I heard.
Afraid we have to wrap it up there. In fact, we're over time, but I do want one last quick question to each of the panelists, if you don't mind. So I'm going to ask it myself. Forgive me. Okay, title of the book is Reimagining India, Unlocking the Potential of Asia's Next Superpower. In 5 years' time, you reconvene the same 64 writers. What will the subheading be? Rather than Unlocking the Potential of Asia's Next Superpower, will it be, you're the journalist in the room, other than myself, will the subheading be Still Trying to Find the Key? Will it be... I did work for tabloids a long time ago. A long time ago.
That's right.
Will it be Will on the Path? Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, if you force me to answer it, I think 5 years is far too short a time horizon to look at. I mean, I think this is a 25, 30, 40-year process, and no. If it could be unlocked in 5 years, it would be easy.
Okay. But on the path, are you an optimist?
I think that on balance things will look a bit better in 5 years than they do today.
Yes.
But we'll still be talking about the same problems.
Okay. Dad?
I think there is no choice, but it'll look better because my own view is that one of two things is going to happen. We can't go on like this. Either things are going to change after the next election, or we're going to have the wrong government, and India will hit the wall within the next 2 or 3 years, and we'll have different leadership, more forceful leadership in place, which will sort things out. I think what's going on right now cannot continue. So, to that extent, I'm optimistic.
Okay. A grudging optimist.
Yeah, I'm optimistic. Final word to you.
Sorry, there's an essay in the book that talks about the fact that India only reforms in a crisis, right? That unless there's a crisis, it's just too difficult, or it doesn't find a way to do it. So the interesting question is the crisis of today enough to have that change? If it is, then I'm absolutely certain it will be there. If you ask me what the odds are, I think they're better than 50-50.
Okay. Thank you very much. We do have to leave it there. The book is on sale downstairs in the lobby as you walk out. I can thoroughly recommend it. As you can tell, it's triggered a debate which we could continue for many hours, but sadly we do have to wrap. Can you please join me in thanking our panelists for a fascinating discussion? Thank you. And please do join us for a drink and refreshments for the next hour and network, and please chat with some of our guests. Thanks again.